This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
If you've ever known somebody who has committed suicide, or if you, maybe yourself, have ever had thoughts about suicide, surely all of us at one point or another have heard about people who just, they reach a point of despair and they just take their own lives. It's an incredible tragedy. And the number of people who are choosing to go down that dark road is increasing, it seems. Well, I'm happy to report to you that researchers from the University of Maryland are working on a potential vocal tracking app that could detect worrying changes in somebody's symptoms of depression. So this is from study finds. More than 260 million people worldwide suffer from major depression disorder, MDD, while another 20 million have schizophrenia, according to the World Health Organization. Doctors say the major depression disorder, MDD, and schizophrenia are among the most common precursors to suicide. And according to a 2018 report, suicide is the second leading cause of death in children and young adults in the United States. Professor Carol Espy Wilson says the coordination of someone's speech gestures reflects the mental health status of that person. Her study explains that a speech inversion system maps acoustic signals to vocal track variables. I know this sounds a little bit boring, but let's push past the science here. This shows the timing and the spatial movement of speech gestures. When someone is dealing with depression, this speech coordination changes. Depression, she says, is accompanied by a psychomotor slowing. As a result, they cannot think as fast and their speaking rate is slowed with more and longer pauses than if they were not depressed. What this means is that there is less co-production of neighboring sounds and more of the sounds are fully articulated. That is, the articulators reach their targets. I know that this sounds somewhat impenetrable. Essentially, you know, in my layman's capacity, I understand this to mean that they can map kind of acoustic rhythms and pauses and the way things are said and the speed at which they're said. And they can correlate between somebody who's depressed and somebody who's not depressed on the basis of those factors, on the basis of those artifacts in our speech. The study authors add the use of machine learning techniques to help provide data for deep learning models for mental health classification. Professor Espy Wilson says that the goal of the research is to use technology, maybe even in the form of a smartphone app, that will help patients and those around them stay informed about their mental health, something that she believes could have a huge impact on the world. Ideally, she says, therapists will give the app to patients who suffer from MDD when they are in remission and or only have mild depression. That is, they're in a state when they are likely to use it regularly, so their mental health status can be tracked and people will be alerted if the app detects that the severity of the depression is increasing. I think this is a brilliant idea. Put it on an app and have the person carry it around in the pocket. I presume it probably would just keep track of what they have to say in general. I mean, there may be some privacy concerns there that would have to be worked out. But imagine if you had the ability to, you know, maybe you've got a neighbor or a relative or somebody who's going through a time of depression, and an app like this could send an alert and say, this is getting worse. That might be a way to help forestall the terrible decision on that person's part of committing suicide. So if you're interested in reading that article, you'll find it on the show Twitter feed, as with all the other articles. Just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you'll find the Twitter feed embedded on the page there. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Adam listening in Salt Lake City. Hello, Adam. Hello, Adam.
Hello?
Yes. Hello? Am I pronouncing your name correctly, first of all? Is it Adam?
It's Adam, A-D-O-M.
Adam. I'm sorry. My mistake.
Patrick, my question is, on the years that Christ was kind of not seen, from 13 to in the 20s, did he, do you know, did he go to the Orient and study with the Himalayan Tibetans and the Dalai Lamas and that type of scenario?
No, No, he didn't. He did not. So these are sometimes thought of as the hidden years of Jesus. So when he was about 12 years old, he went with his parents. When he was 12 years old, I should say, he went with his parents up to Jerusalem. And that's where the finding in the temple incident took place. Now, from that point forward until the time of his public ministry, we know exactly where Jesus was. He was not in India studying with the Swamis. He was in Nazareth with his parents. And we're told that in Luke 2, verse 51, and he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was obedient to them, and his mother kept all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. So those two verses right there tell us that he was with them. Now, there's an interesting detail here. Luke was not one of the 12 apostles. Luke came later. And Luke got his information not just under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, that, of course, was primary, but he also received information about the life of Jesus, as he himself says in the beginning of his gospel. Let me just read this to you because it has a bearing on your question. So St. Luke begins his gospel with the following words. He says, let me flip to that page here. He says, since many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as those who were eyewitnesses from the beginning and ministers of the word have handed them down to us, I too have decided, after investigating everything accurately anew, to write it down in an orderly sequence for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may realize the certainty of the teachings you have received. Now, the nugget in this passage that goes to the heart of your question is where he says, first of all, that we received this information from the eyewitnesses. They were handed down to us. So that means that St. Luke knew the eyewitnesses. He interviewed them. He spent time with them. He asked them, tell me what happened. Give me the story. And then after, you might say, canvassing the various people who would have known this, then he constructs it in this chronological fashion so that it's easier for us to understand it from beginning to end. Who do you think he would have had to have asked about this? Our Lady herself. Because obviously, when Jesus was 12 years old, he had not met any of the men who would become his apostles. They were probably kids themselves at that point. So the one person, with the exception perhaps of St. Joseph, who probably was no longer alive, almost certainly was no longer alive, but the one person who definitely did know what exactly happened would be Our Lady. And St. Luke tells us that it was this careful interviewing process and getting all the notes down that led to him being able to write the gospel the way he did. So he got this information from her. And maybe from some close relatives who might still have been alive at that time, who would have known exactly what happened. So all of this hullabaloo that you see, and this has been around for some time now, people claiming that, well, Jesus had to go to India, and he learned how to do what he wound up doing in his public life. That's rubbish. If you look at Luke's gospel, at the finding in the temple in Luke chapter 2, you see that when his parents found him, they found him sitting among the teachers, it says in verse 46, and he was listening to them and asking them questions, and all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. So, in other words, this boy of 12 years old, he was teaching these elders. They were the ones who were, up to that point anyway, the repository of knowledge and information about God and such. And so they were amazed at what he knew. And the reason is because he's God and he was teaching them these things. So he had no need to go to India to learn anything from anybody. It would have been completely superfluous. Jesus didn't need to know how to learn about God or the things of God. He was the one who was there to inform other people. So those parts going together, Adam, I think are the best way to answer your question. Even though people claim that Jesus went to India or to some other place to learn whatever, it's not true. And the evidence that we have in Scripture, I think, clearly bears that out. Does that help?
That sure does. Thank you so much, Patrick, for your time.
You're welcome. I appreciate your phone call. Let's go now to Faith in Algoma, Wisconsin. Hello, Faith. They tell me you're 13 years old. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, welcome to the program.
My friend, she I didn't know this until she told me a couple days ago. She said mm-hmm. that she wanted to be a boy, Okay. And today at 4 o'clock, she's going in for a haircut, and I don't know. I mean, I don't want to hurt her feelings, but yet I want to tell her that it's wrong, and I don't know if, like, is it a sin to, like, hang out with her? And, like, because I don't, she wants me to call her by Michael now instead of Marley. So, and I don't, like, what should I do? Because I still want to call her by Marley, because, I mean, she's still a girl, and she's always going to be a girl. But, I mean, I just don't want to, like, lose that friendship or stuff like that.
I get you, and I can understand how you feel. It's got to be confusing for you and probably makes you feel kind of sad, too, because she's your friend and you care about her, but she's going in a direction that you're concerned about, right?
Mm-hmm. And her mom, she doesn't agree with it at all. And her dad, he's always at work, so he can't really do anything. And it's like I don't know what to do because she's really nice. And I tried talking to her, and she's like, well, I want to do this. I want to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think the main part of it, she was like, she was so nice. She was so bubbly when she was little, like when I knew her when we first moved to Algoma. And it's all because of her, the friends that she has. Mm-hmm. One of her friends, she wants to be a boy too, and she gets ticked off when I call her by Brittany still. I don't really care because that's her name. Mm-hmm. Her other one, she's gay, and it's really frustrating because and they live kind of close, and they always come over every weekend. And the two friends, they don't like me, but I don't really care, and I feel like it's just the friends, and I don't want her to hang out with them. And I feel like if she would have never hanged out with them, she would not be in this situation, and I don't know what to do. And I mean...
Yeah. I understand, and it's got to be very difficult for you. Did you say that those friends come over to your house to hang out?
No, over to her house, but then I just live across the street from her.
Okay. So you see them in the neighborhood, and if you're visiting with Marley, then you often see these other girls, right?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a Bible passage. I just want to share this with you. If you have a pen handy, you can write it down and look at it. But it's 1 Corinthians 15:33, where St. Paul says, "Do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals." Bad company ruins good morals. Now, you're a witness to that happening with your friend. And I think you're absolutely right that if she hadn't had this association with these other friends who were going down the same road and they were influencing her, chances are it never would have come to her. I mean, she never would have thought about that, I'm guessing. So there's probably some pressure, if I had to guess, probably some pressure that's being applied to her. And there's certainly pressure being applied to you to go along with it, right? They may say, well, we know that Faith will never do this, but Faith better go along with it because, you know, she has to agree with what we're doing. So what do you do? Well, you could do a couple things. One is you could become like a missionary to them. You could, for as long as they're willing to tolerate it, you could speak the truth to them. You could point out.
And I've tried doing that.
What do they do?
And I've tried like doing that. Like I've tried telling them like God says it's wrong and stuff. And her friends have actually gotten kind of physical with me sometimes. Like they. One time they threw
some mud
at me because I said something. Yeah, and I don't mind it, but I mean, like, they've been doing that, but, and it's like my mom, I told her about it, and she kind of leaves them all for me, so I'm kind of stuck in this position where I can't really do anything. And I mean, Marley, she's not pushing me to call her Michael. She's just kind of telling me, and I feel really sorry for her because she doesn't know that it's wrong. And she's asking me, what should I wear? And I'm telling, she's like, well, I want to wear baggy clothes, she said. I'm like, I don't know what to tell her. And is this wrong? I told her to wear something plaid. I mean, like, I said, well, you should go to the mall. And I'm thinking that she can come with me and then we can buy some clothes that she thinks are a boy, but it's like for girls and she'll feel safe wearing them. And I don't know, like, would that be okay? Because, I mean, I want her to still be a girl, and I mean, if she thinks that it's boy clothes, because I mean, she still wears girl clothes, but she's like, it's, I don't know how to say it, but it's interesting.
Yeah, I can understand how confusing it must be for you. What if you tried this, Faith? What if you, the next time you're talking to her, you said, I want to ask you a question. If you knew somebody, and let's say it was me. So this is you speaking to her, okay? And you say, let's say it was me. And I had developed anorexia. And you know what anorexia is, right? It's an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd say to her, what would you say to me if I developed anorexia and in my own mind I was convinced that I was overweight and I was too fat, and because of this eating disorder I would starve myself, and you know, I really was getting emaciated and dangerously thin to the point where it could kill me. I mean, it does kill people if they go too far that way. Would you go along with that and just say, yeah, okay, well, if you think you're fat, great, we'll just pretend that you're fat. And would you enable me with that eating disorder? Or would you say, listen, we got to get you some help, because if you continue down this road, it's going to be miserable for you. And just ask her that question. Which would you do if I had anorexia? And it would be interesting to see what her reaction is. So if her reaction is, well, I would try to get you some help, then you'd say, well, thank you, because that means that you're a good friend, and you would step in and tell me something, even if I didn't believe it. If you knew that it was true, you would try to help me to see reality. Well, that's what I'm trying to do here with you, you're saying to her. That's what I'm trying to do here with you. You're not a boy. You're not going to become a boy and wearing the clothing or cutting your hair or, God forbid, more things down the road than that. That's not going to make you a boy. You still are who you are. And that wasn't assigned to you by anyone else. You were created by God because he loves you. And he has a plan for you. And if you're experiencing frustration or you're experiencing confusion, understandable. And there are ways that we can work with that and help with that. But this solution that you think is going to help you is actually going to make your life more miserable in the long run. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Faith, there is a place, there's a website. Now, you're only 13 years old, so I really want to emphasize that you need to make sure your mom and dad are involved in this, and be sure to tell them. Is your mom listening right now? I kind of hope she is listening to our conversation. Is she in the room?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give you a resource, but I want you to make use of this only with your mother's permission, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's a website called sexchangeregret.com. Sexchangeregret.com. And it is a website that features one particular man who believes that he transitioned to become a woman, and he lived that way for 8 years. And then he realized he had made a big mistake. But there are videos, there are resources, there are articles from a clinical, medical, psychological standpoint that can help people before they go too far down this road and deeply regret it. So it talks a lot about people who have gone in that direction and then they've regretted it. So if you would ask your mom if it's okay with her, that maybe you can look at this with her. There's nothing there that's going to offend your purity or anything like that. But it's a topic that's typically not one that I would recommend to a 13-year-old, but since you're in this situation. So that will help you understand what's going on. And it will also help you to know how to speak to your friend so that you can help her. Hopefully you can help her.
And another reason, I don't want to go too far.
Go ahead.
Sorry. And then, like, I don't want to go too far because then she's going to cut me off. And then I don't think she would do that. But, I mean, I don't want to get her ticked off.
Let's talk about that. You know, at 13 years of age, I understand how important your friends are. I remember being your age and how important my friends are at that point. But I can tell you something. The chances are pretty good that by the time you are 23 years old, 33 years old, You won't be friends with these people. Life will go on and things will change and you'll move, or they'll move. So the friends that you have when you're 13 years old, most of the time are not friends that you'll have later on. So it's not that you don't like her. Or it's not that you don't find value in the friendship, but ultimately, what if she does get ticked off? You know, is that really that big of a deal? I don't think it is. And the other girls who are throwing mud at you, or you said getting physical with you, I mean, I would cut that off immediately and just not be around them. And, you know, if they're across the street at Marley's house, don't go over there. You know, don't answer their phone calls or text messages. Just phase that out, because you don't need that kind of friction in your life. You don't need those problems in your life. You have other things to worry about, like being 13 years old and enjoying being, you know, going into high school and all the wonderful things at that stage of life. You shouldn't be burdened with these things. So if you need to just close the door on that, I would do that and find other friends and not be burdened by it. Remember that passage. Think about that passage from 1 Corinthians 15. Bad company ruins good morals. And over time, if you're not careful, that can really have its effect. So be careful. Let me give you one other resource, Faith. Do you have your pen handy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is a book.
Okay.
This is a book by Ryan Anderson. And it is called When Harry Became Sally. H-A-R-R-Y. When Harry Became Sally. And it's a book that explains this phenomenon of the transgender movement. It's very compassionate. It's very well footnoted and documented. And it will be helpful to you if you read this book. Maybe you can read it with your mom. And it'll help you understand at a bigger, broader level a lot of the things that are going on here. And that will help you know what to say. Now, that book may not be able to find it easily on Amazon, because Amazon is afraid of this book because it speaks the truth, and so they tried to hide it from people so that they can't find it. So if you want to get it, you may not be able to get it on Amazon, but you can definitely get it by going to Ryan Anderson's website. And let me see if I can find that for you. Well, there's a basketball player by the same name. But so you want to look up Ryan Anderson, author of this book, and you'll be able to find it. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. I want you to know that we'll all be praying for you. This is a heavy burden for somebody as young as you. But I want to compliment you. The fact that you're even calling me and the fact that you're thinking about how you can help, that really says a lot of good about you, Faith. I'm happy for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, and make sure your mom knows all about this that we talked about, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Wow, I feel so sad for the kids today who have to deal with things like this. I never had to deal with this when I was 13 years old. But this is the world we live in, so we make the best of what we've got, right? I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show, where you never know what's going to happen. Talk about unpredictable conversations. The way to have one with me is to call 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Back to the phones now. Let's go to Brian in Riverside, California. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. I just wanted to ask your thoughts. Why are some girls so desperate to go through with abortion, and why they're trying to, you know, make this their crusade? I know why the ones who have had it have to do that, because the moment they do it, Satan whispers in their ear, hey, you didn't just kill your child, did you? And now they have to fight for it. Otherwise, the reality of what they've done is going to come to haunt them. You know, at least they repent and accept Christ, but that's a whole other issue they might not want to do. Why are some girls, I watched a political commentator, and there was a young girl giving a high school speech on, you know, her right to abortion and how, you know, it's being threatened. It's so sad. Just why?
Well, okay. Fair. It's a fair question. I don't know that I can give you anything more than just my conjecture. You know, as a man, I don't have the experience that a woman would have of thinking, well, gee, what if I got pregnant, you know? So there are several things that come to my mind. One is maybe she knows that her mom had an abortion, Or maybe she knows that a sister or a friend had an abortion, even if she herself didn't. Someone close to her, or maybe more than one person close to her, has had an abortion, and it's maybe partly a kind of a psychological protection mechanism, where if I advocate in favor of this and convince myself that it's actually a good thing, then I don't have to feel bad about the person I know and love who had an abortion. That could be one possibility. Another possibility, and I think this is more likely in any case, and that is that these young women are being radicalized. They're being radicalized in school from the time that they're in the earliest grades. Planned Parenthood has its tentacles slithering into even grammar schools. The indoctrination begins very early. So I attribute, if I had to guess, again, I'm just conjecturing here, but I think it's an educated guess, I think that a lot of this has to do with the indoctrination, and they are just force-fed this ideology, and after a while, it's in them, and it sticks, and we see it come out when, you see them, arguing for or agitating for abortion, even if the girl herself has never had one. She's been indoctrinated to see herself as an empowered warrior for civil rights, styling herself almost as if she was like an abolitionist against slavery, when in fact abortion, of course, is the 21st century analog to the slavery problem in the 19th century, even worse, as bad as slavery itself was. So part of the indoctrination is this notion that you are actually fighting for somebody's civil rights. And when, typically when people enter into adolescence and they get even a little bit older, they want to fight for a cause bigger than themselves. They want to be part of a bigger movement. That's what we saw with the anti-war movement in the 60s and 70s as a good example of harnessing that youthful desire to make a difference and to strike a blow for human rights and things of that nature. Usually as you get older, those tendencies tend to become somewhat more attenuated, but at that age, they're very strong. So those are a couple of conjectures off the top of my head, Brian. What is your thought about that?
Yeah, I like what you said. I love both examples as far as, wanting to be a part of something bigger. That's something I never really take into account. Or the fact that someone they know might have had an abortion. And I've known multiple women in my life who have gone through with it and had an abortion. It makes me scratch my head, though, when I attended 40 Days for Life. You know, you meet some broken woman through that. It makes me sad that people are so hankering to possibly go down that route, I don't know. I just feel they'll regret it, and I feel it will haunt them, and they can find forgiveness and healing, but obviously that's done through, the means God gave us through Christ, and most people hate God and hate Christ, I feel, but thank you so much.
I'm not sure that I think most people hate Christ. I think most people are apathetic. There are some who do,
I think people hate Christ. I think people hate God, and I feel bad for feeling like this, Patrick, and I was always wondered your thoughts on it. I truly believe so much of the sin and, rebellion we see in society, I truly believe people hate God. They hate Christian morality. They hate the foundation. That's why they hate the Catholic Church. And it's why they hate the Jews, who are the forerunners from Christianity, They hate morality through a Judeo-Christian lens.
I'll grant you that there are people who do fit that description. I've met some of them, and it's frightening, as you probably know yourself. But I don't think that the majority of people would fit that description. And I'll just put it this way. I hope that the majority of people are not as you just described. And if they are, then heaven help us. But I think most people are just, they go along to get along. There's this sort of soft radicalization that takes place. I mentioned earlier in our schools. So it's happening there. But it's also people are being radicalized on a daily basis by the YouTube and TikTok videos they watch, by the movies they watch, by the music they listen to, the peer pressure that comes in through social media. And they're taught that if you get out of line, if you hold a view that's other than what the majority of people think is right about whether it's, your lifestyle choices or what have you, that you'll be punished if you get out of line. And that's a subtle message, and sometimes not so subtle, but it's a subtle message that seeps in and permeates their mindset. And so, when somebody doesn't have deeply held convictions, why bother? Why not just go along to get along? So maybe it's, I hope, I'll put it that way, Brian, that the majority of people are not as you describe. And if you're right, then we have an even bigger problem. But I do grant you that there are certain people who really do hate morality for whatever reason. I don't understand it. But anyway, I'm glad we had a chance to talk today, Brian. Thank you. And thanks for adding your voice to the conversation. 888-914-9149. Another great resource, as long as we're at it, the wonderful Lila Rose. She has an organization called Live Action, and you should get familiar with this. Liveaction.org is the website. She has a brand new book out, as a matter of fact. And what is the? I have a copy. It came to me as a review copy. It's called Fighting for Life: Becoming a Force for Change in a Wounded World by Lila Rose. That would be a very good book for anybody who wants to know how I can go about being more effective at helping people who see abortion as completely desirable and normal. That's just one of a number of books that are available at her website, which is liveaction.org. I encourage you, go there and take a look at all these wonderful resources. And in addition to the books and other things, she's also got a number of videos from her interviews in media, and those are also very powerful. If you know a young woman who's thinking about an abortion, or she's just in that milieu and she could be influenced in that direction, grab a link to one of these videos and just text her the link. You don't have to text her the link to the whole site. Just text her a link to the video, because they're looking at videos on their phones anyway. And she'll click on that and she'll watch it. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Jackson. Jackson, welcome. Where are you located, Jackson?
In Albuquerque.
Okay, welcome.
All right, so hopefully a simple question for you. How would you defend the fact that Christ has to be fully God and fully man against the position that he could be some percentage of either, like some sort of Greek demigod or something?
I would defend it on the basis that the church has defined it dogmatically, that Christ is true God and true man, not a percentage of either one.
Any, do you have any other arguments for that, or is it just...
Well, let me ask you a question. Is that a doctrine that you accept or don't accept? Or, you know, where's this question coming from?
I'm planning on essentially defending the hypostatic union as far as, because I'm an RCIA leader. So okay. I'm part of one of the upcoming classes.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that, because I was concerned for a minute that maybe you were questioning or denying that. Well, I mean, the church in the councils that met beginning with the First Council of Nicaea in the year 325 and the subsequent councils that dealt with these Christological questions, who is Jesus and what is Jesus? All of those councils in their deliberations were dealing with responding to errors or aberrant theologies, heresies essentially, that called this into question. So those councils, they focused upon two things, not only these two things, but primarily these two things. What does it say to us in divine revelation? What does the Bible, what does apostolic tradition say to us that God has revealed about Jesus? But also, what are some of the implications that must be drawn from the things that are explicitly told to us? So not everything is explicitly told to us in the Bible. It doesn't explicitly say that there is one God in three persons, for example. Now, it's true, and there are implications that we must draw from those explicit truths. There are certain inferences that we draw, and we can say that the inferences must be true themselves because of the things, the premises that underlie them. So such things as, well, if Jesus isn't fully God, if he's just like a superhuman creature and still only a creature, well, then we're still dead in our sins, because if human beings had the capacity naturally to save ourselves, if we could die for somebody else, or if we could do something else to save ourselves, then there'd be no reason for the incarnation. There'd be no reason for Jesus to be here, because it, at best, that would be superfluous. So one of the inferences that we would draw from this is that by being God, he accomplished something that human beings can't do for themselves. Now, I realize that that in itself does not get to the question that you're asking about how can we defend whether, you know, how do we defend the church's teaching that he is true God and true man with all that that entails in both cases, both natures. But I would say if you want to do a deep study, look at what the council said. They're easily available online. They're, you know, you don't have to buy a book even. You can just look them up online. And you can see how they formulated these decrees or these canons, these teachings, as a way to foreclose on a heresy and to say, well, this heresy that says that Jesus only appeared to be human, he was really divine in kind of a human costume. Well, that's not true for these reasons. And you'll see there where they elucidate the scriptural passages to back that up. That would be one way to go about it. You can also get a good book on Christology. So Father Rock Caresti has a book called Jesus the Christ. It came out maybe 30 years ago. And that's a one-volume Christology. It's not perfect, but I'd say it's very helpful, and it will give you a lot of the details about, you know, the heresies and how the church responded to the heresies. A book like that, I think, would be helpful as well. And I know at the beginning you asked for a simple answer or suggested that, but I think this is such an important question that it deserves a bit more than just a one or two line answer.
All right. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome, Jackson. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Break time. We'll do that now and come right back to your phone calls. The number to dial is 888-914-9149. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I posted an image on Twitter. Cyrus, as I told you, is taking some time off. And I posted an image on my Twitter feed. Cyrus was pretty excited when he left the Relevant Radio studios. I posted this yesterday. He's starting a well-deserved week of vacation. We'll miss you while you're gone. And so if you want to see how happy he was, just go there and you'll see. In fact, I will bump it to the top. I'll retweet that baby. So it's right there at the top. So if you want to see how happy Cyrus was starting vacation, you'll see it there. Back to the phones, 888-914-9149. We'll start off now in Cranberry, Pennsylvania, and talk to Jake. Good morning, Jake.
Good morning, sir. We've been talking this week a bunch about going to the school board meetings. Advocate that. Great idea. Mm-hmm. Is there such a thing, or could we make, if there isn't such a thing, the parish board meeting or the church board meeting you tell me, you're the boss.
Well, parish council is the structure that's most common at Catholic parishes, where they advise the pastor on, you know, financial matters or other things pertaining to the parish. They don't have any power. They can't actually do anything, but they're in an advisory capacity. So that comes to my mind as you're asking this question.
Okay, a parish council.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and just thinking about all these issues that we're facing today, and you sit there in church and you're paying attention like you're supposed to, and the priest giving the homily seemingly goes off track, and I would guess that you remember this. I don't remember where it is in the Bible, but you know, if somebody's doing wrong, go get another brother and bring them to them, and if that doesn't work, go get another one, and that's kind of what I'm thinking. Like, to maybe
is there a situation going on in your parish that you're trying to remedy?
Just trying to keep it, you know, I'm 52 years old here and I have been in church my whole life. And it seems like, maybe a little, liberation theology, creeping in, you know, maybe I haven't heard direct support for the pride movement. But, you know, questioning, well, Black Lives Matter isn't so bad. You know, are we, do we know if we're supposed to be on the side of Black Lives Matter or the police? And I'm screaming in my head, yes, we're supposed to be on the side of the police.
Mm-hmm. So, sounds like you've got a pastor or maybe more than one priest who is left of center politically and maybe way left of center and perhaps even theologically. So if you're wondering what you can do, here's my honest take, Jake. First of all, I don't know. I mean, any given parish will handle it their own way. But generally, my impression is that parish council meetings are not open to the public. They're working meetings where the parish council comes together. The priest is there and they sort through the business that they have to deal with. So I don't think it's like a school board meeting where it's open to the public or some other publicly accessible type of meeting where the citizens can come up and voice their opinion. I don't think you're going to have that option, if I had to guess. So if you wanted to take it up with the parish or with the parish priest, and I think the passage you're referring to is in Matthew chapter 18, where Jesus lays out this paradigm. If you have something against your brother, go to him in person, tell him the problem. If it works, great, you've won over your brother. If it doesn't work, then take two or three witnesses. If that doesn't work, tell the church. And if he won't listen even to the church, then treat him as if he were a tax collector or a Gentile. So with that paradigm in mind, maybe the first thing to do would be to write a letter to the parish priest and just say, here's some things I've been hearing. I find it distracting, or whatever it is that your reaction is that you want to share with him. And I'd appreciate it if you could just not do that. Now, I'm guessing, Jake, he's probably going to get ticked off at you. And he's probably going to get defensive and push back or ignore you. He might ignore you. But however,
yeah, he might even not answer my phone calls. Right.
He might not. And I don't know if a phone call is the right way to go about it. The reason being is, you know, when you're on the phone, you're on the spot. When you have a letter or an email, you have time to think about it, read it, reread it. And you're not on the spot. You don't have to give someone an answer in the moment. So that might be one way to keep the temperature lower. Also, there's a record of it. You know, if you have a phone conversation, you don't have a record of that, and people can misremember things. So,
Very good.
I guess what I'm leading up to now is this. Let me just say this, Jake. If you can get some kind of relief that way, great, but I don't think it's likely. I think it's likely to blow up in your face. The easiest way to handle this, if you ask me, with the least amount of wear and tear for you, is go to a different parish. And maybe you'll find out in 3 years' time that priest has been reassigned, then you can come back. But at least you're not putting yourself in that situation.
Now, it'd be a great idea, and we have done that. I guess the bigger question is, how do we protect the church as a whole, you know, from this issue? Is there anything that says we can't have that quote-unquote school board meeting for the church? You know,
no,
is there any doctrine? Is there any?
No, but let me offer you a cautionary tale. There is a long history in this country, and I'm sure it's true in other parts of the world, but certainly in this country, there's a long history of concerned lay people starting their committee, starting their group, starting their website, starting their whatever, and pursuing the project of trying to expose or refute or oppose what's going on in a parish or a diocese. I mean, these kinds of things have been around a long time. They usually come to nothing. They usually end up just maybe assuaging the angry feelings that the lay people have, and it usually doesn't really amount to anything beyond that. I don't see that as a path that I would recommend, because it seems futile to me. And you ask the question, what can we do to protect the church? The answer is nothing. This is beyond what you and I can do. We can't fix this problem, whatever the problems are in a given parish. We can't fix it. If you go to war over it, it just creates a lot of misery and problems and factions, and we already have enough of those. So I think the most prudent course of action is not to form a committee or a blog or something, but just go to a different parish and write it out in relative tranquility. And then eventually, when your parish gets a different priest, you can come back if you think that he's better. But why put yourself through all that wear and tear when ultimately it's not going to amount to anything? I don't think you're going to be able to change it. And I don't say that as a defeatist, but as a realist. You know, think of it this way, Jake. This is Jesus Christ's church. It doesn't belong to Pope Francis. It doesn't belong to the bishop. It doesn't belong to the priest. It doesn't belong to you or to me. It belongs to Jesus. This is his church. And we are members of his church, members of his body. And if it's his will that his church should go through turmoil and problems, then so be it. And I just want to be on that arc with him. It's not my place to try to change it. I want to be faithful. And if I need to suffer along the way, so be it. But because it's Christ's church, not mine, I'm content to let him handle those management details, you know, because I can't handle the management details. You know, I'm in sales, as somebody once said, not management. That's not my department. So, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, I absolutely hear it, and then I think of St. Ignatius or St. Patrick, and they went and did stuff about it, right? There was a wrong. They wanted to fix
That's
it.
True. St. Patrick was a bishop, and he was also sent by the Pope to do what he did, so he had a mandate. I'm not saying that you can't speak up or speak out. I mean, it's not my place to tell you that either, but I'm not trying to discourage you from speaking the truth. All I'm saying is I've seen what you're in right now so many times over my life, and I see that almost always it comes to nothing. It just results in more problems and nothing gets changed. And
what would I be if I didn't try? So, I appreciate your wise counsel, and I just look at the problem moving to another area, and then other people having to deal with it, and so on and so on. And hey, we're all on the same team. We just might not be seemingly going for the same goal at this point.
You and me, or just you and the priest?
Me and the priest. I think me and you are,
we're simpatico. We are. That's true. Well, I wish you well.
I appreciate it, Patrick.
You got it, Jake. You got it. Thanks for the call. Yeah, I can understand people's frustration. Been there, done that. I totally understand it. And I'll just share with you something that happened to me. My wife and I were young parents at the time, and we had, I don't know, we had maybe 3-4 kids, and we were at Sunday Mass, and there was a visiting priest, young guy, and he was preaching a sermon after the Mass, and his sermon included some of these items. He said, for example, that St. Paul hated women. Because I think the verse that was preached on from the second reading that day was the passage in Ephesians where St. Paul says, wives, be submissive to your husbands. You remember that one? It's kind of like the one that all the priests dread, or at least I've heard that from some of them, because people get up in arms. But in any case, so he said, St. Paul was a woman hater. And he also said that Pope John Paul II, who was the Pope at the time, you know, he said, and did he make a really big mistake when he went to Guatemala and he said X, Y, or Z, or he, you know, something like that. And I was so outraged by that. It's the first and only time in my life I've ever done this, and I don't recommend it. Looking back on it now, I wish I hadn't done this. But the first and only time in my life that in the middle of his sermon, Nancy and I got up, I, you know, took her hand and said, we're leaving. So she stood up with me. We gathered the children, and we were sitting kind of in the middle of this very crowded church, maybe 1,000 people. We were in the midsection of the pews, in the middle of the pew that we were in. And so when we got up and walked out, I mean, there was a hush. The priest stopped speaking, And there was this very awkward 30 seconds when this, you know, little family got up and walked out of the church. And it was obviously that we were objecting to what he was saying. And so I felt bad about that afterward. But in the moment, I felt like I got to do something. I've got to make a gesture. I've got to do something. And so I called the rectory later that day after I had cooled down. And I asked if I could speak to the priest. Can I meet with you? He said, sure, come on over. And he was pleasant. He was kind of condescending, but he was pleasant. And so I met with him in the parlor of the rectory, and we sat and talked. And I said, you shouldn't be saying things to the people like that, because it's not only not true, it also is scandalous to people. And he sort of patted me on the head, and he, you know, offered a few bland things. And to his credit, he didn't get angry. He didn't get defensive or anything. But he basically, it was like Teflon. It was like throwing ping pong balls at a tank. And after we were done, we shook hands and I walked away. And I thought, well, that didn't accomplish anything. And I've never forgotten that. So for me, that personal experience was instructive. And take it for what it's worth. You know, we do the best we can. This is Jesus Christ's church, not mine, not yours. And if he sees fit to let his church go through a situation, let's just keep pressing forward, shall we? I'll be right back with hour 3 right after this. Now.